Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As fall approaches, cases of COVID-19 are on the rise, even as the country has yet to totally emerge from a late summer wave of infections driven by the new Stratus variant. Since the dawn of vaccines to prevent or reduce the symptoms of COVID, those shots have been relatively easy to obtain, and medical recommendations about receiving them have been straightforward. All most people had to do was walk into a pharmacy and ask for the shot. But recent changes brought about by the Trump administration and by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have substantially complicated the process. Confusion over who is now eligible is the order of the day, and is just where you can get a shot and whether or not you now need a prescription to get one. Further complicating matters is the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics and others and the Centers for Disease Control are no longer on the same page when it comes to COVID vaccinations for young children. And the same confusion is at play when it comes to what pregnant women should do. RFK says the CDC would no longer recommend healthy pregnant women receive the vaccine. However, many medical experts disagree with that recommendation. As with so many situations since January 20th, this is yet another unprecedented situation, but one that also impacts your health and public health in general. So this hour, we seek some advice from medical experts. We welcome back Dr. Raynard Washington, Mecklenburg County's public health director. He's here along with Dr. David Wall, professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina. And Dr. Andrew Pekosh is professor and vice chair of the Department of Molecular and Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Good morning to all three of you. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Real pleasure.
So, Dr. Wall, I'm going to start with you. At the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, COVID was a killer. Is it still?
Unfortunately, yes. And while we're nowhere near like we were during the peak of the devastation that we saw early in the pandemic, Mike, it's important to realize that in February of this year, two out of 100 deaths of all deaths in the United States were due to COVID-19. Right now, it's about 0.8. So almost one out of every 100 people dying in the United States right now is dying from COVID-19. Now, last week it was 0.6, so we're going up. So I think many of the listeners would be surprised to know that one out of 100 people now dying in our country are dying from COVID-19. So it's there, it's real, and it is still deadly for a lot of people.
And are the people who are losing their lives to this at the moment those who have chosen to be or simply are unvaccinated, or have some of them been vaccinated but still succumbed to the virus?
Yeah, really good question. Much easier to answer in a place like Canada or Israel or some Middle East countries or even some European countries where they have a centralized database where they can click some buttons and find that out. We don't have that. It's hard to know exactly what's going on with vaccination, prior infection, because we don't have that kind of centralized data. As you can imagine, though, people who are most vulnerable are people who've not been vaccinated or not been vaccinated recently and not recently infected, as well as people who are immunocompromised or older. Now, we should also point out, and I know we'll talk about pediatrics, remember, newborn babies have never had COVID before, right? So very young children didn't experience what we all experienced 2 to 3 years ago, where most of us have gotten infected. They're naive to the infection. So unfortunately, we're seeing, again, the extremes of age being at most risk.
So is it accurate to say then that young unvaccinated children who have never been exposed because they weren't around during the pandemic to this virus would react to this current variant the way we would have reacted back when the pandemic was at its height?
That's right. So young children who've not had any immunization or exposure to the virus are naive to it and thus vulnerable. Now, newborn babies do have antibodies transferred from mom. So if mom is vaccinated, those antibodies transfer to the baby, protecting the baby for a month. That's why when we talk about pregnant women and getting them vaccinated, it's not only for their health and benefit, but also for their newborn. So yes, you're exactly right. And I think people are missing that message that the vaccination of pregnant women is beneficial for at least two people.
So Dr. Washington, just to remind people, over 1.1 million people have died in the United States alone from early 2020 through 2025 from COVID. It was among the top three causes of death from 2020 to 2022. Mecklenburg County in North Carolina also suffered. I think nearly 30,000 people in our state died from COVID since 2020, over 1,900 of them in Mecklenburg County alone. These vaccines were lifesavers. I think there's no disputing the fact that these vaccines saved hundreds of millions of lives. So given the mutations that this virus goes through regularly, are the vaccines currently on the market effective? In your opinion, are they still necessary, Dr. Washington?
Yeah, thanks, Mike, and good morning to you. I think certainly, given the information that was just shared here by Dr. Wall, you know, COVID is still a challenge for our community. It is still causing severe illness. It's still causing hospitalizations. And as was already mentioned, particularly for folks who are either medically vulnerable or folks who are on those extremes, older adults, really young children whose immune systems are also vulnerable, either because of age or because of lack of development yet. For those individuals, COVID does pose a serious, significant threat. If we look at last respiratory virus season, we saw a number of spikes in hospitalizations, particularly among young children, as well as older adults. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a first of probably several outbreaks in long-term care facilities where we have some of our most medically fragile adults living in the community. Again, without COVID vaccines available, that outbreak expanded pretty quickly from just a couple of cases to more than 50. So I think the risk is still there, and it's important for us, while the majority of adults who are healthy and don't have complicating chronic illnesses are able to recover from COVID, very similar to the common cold or even the flu, there are others in our community who are very vulnerable, folks who are on certain types of therapeutics, cancer treatment, chemotherapy. Really, these are lifesavers for them, and it's important that we continue to maintain access.
Dr. Prakash, the original vaccines that stopped this pandemic cold occurred and were developed during the first Trump administration as the result of something they called Operation Warp Speed. It was a major accomplishment, both scientifically and politically. So take us back. The only reason that the speed with which these vaccines were developed was because the mRNA research into mRNA vaccines was already well underway. Correct me if I'm wrong. And they could then apply what they knew from previous research to developing a vaccine that specifically targeted the COVID virus. And yet people have become suspicious of these mRNA vaccines. So explain what mRNA vaccines are, how they are formulated, how they work.
It's a really important point that I do agree with you gets sometimes lost in some of the discussions around mRNA vaccines. mRNA vaccine technology was not a new technology. It was around for probably 15 years at least before the COVID-19 pandemic in various forms. As with most vaccine platforms, you have years of development where you take what seems like a good idea, you test it in animal models, maybe you even do some small-scale studies in humans. You try to understand the vaccine formulation, what makes it a good vaccine formulation. You try to understand side effects. Again, people care very much about side effects with a vaccine, and you try to understand and modify the vaccine platform to make it as efficacious and as safe as possible. And oftentimes that requires experiments to be done and tweaking of the platform, which was done with the mRNA platform. What makes the mRNA platform really unique is It uses your own cells to make the proteins that your body will then generate a response to. And that mimics very closely what a virus does when it infects you, because it infects your own cells and then your immune system responds to those infected cells. Now, the second thing that was important about these mRNA vaccines is it's not just the vaccine platform, right? What delivers the vaccine. It's the actual protein that the vaccine expresses. And we've also known from years of study how to make that protein express in a way that really optimizes the immune response that's going to protect you. So it really took years of experience working on both of those aspects, the vaccine platform itself, as well as what do you put into that platform to generate a good response, that really came to a culmination with the COVID-19 pandemic. Again, within weeks, vaccines were generated that were not brand new concepts. They utilized the knowledge that was generated from years of experience, applied it to the COVID-19 vaccine, and then tested it to see how well it worked. And we all know it worked really well, particularly in those early years.
Yeah, so those people who say this was slapdash and thrown together at the last minute and that's why we shouldn't trust it are wrong, period, end of sentence, full stop. In your expert opinion, however, as a microbiologist and an immunologist, is there any reason at all to fear these mRNA COVID vaccines or any other mRNA vaccine? Are they any more dangerous than the vaccines that have been in use that are not mRNA based for years, for the flu, for mumps, rubella, for measles, etc.?
Now, they're one of the best studied, now they're one of the best studied vaccine platforms in the history of humans, right? Because so many people got the vaccine and there was such an intense study of the individuals who were vaccinated. And I'll add that research on these platforms continues to go forward to tweak the concept. Moderna, actually, their new vaccine formulation is a little bit different from the original formulation. They've gone in and changed some things to try to make it less reactogenic, meaning that there's less side effects and more efficacious. So it's not like there was also we've got it and we're done and we're never going to look at this again. There's a constant scientific look at the data, see if we can modify things to continue to make a better vaccine that does two things, reduce side effects and also increase efficacy.
The 20th century brought us vaccines that virtually wiped out, Dr. Wall, many of the diseases that regularly took the lives of people. Vaccines were developed that have eradicated measles and mumps and whooping cough and polio and smallpox. So we don't even remember those diseases. Many people don't view them as a threat because they have no experience. They don't know that children were put in iron lung machines because they couldn't breathe and they couldn't walk, etc. With the rise of this vaccine skepticism and the confusing signals right now being sent from the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., what is at risk?
Yeah, you're right. And it reminds me of the song, "You Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone." And I think that's unfortunately the situation that we're facing now.
Let me stop you right now because I asked a question that cannot be answered in the time allotted. So I want to come back to that on the other side of the break and give you a chance to explain what's at risk here with the rise in vaccine skepticism and particularly the confusion coming out of the CDC, because it is almost impossible to understand what we're supposed to do now. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about COVID and the confusing instructions coming out of the CDC and other federal organizations that have traditionally been very clear about their recommendations for medical procedures and medical processes. And as COVID season begins, we want to clear some of this up. We're here with Dr. Reynard Washington, Public Health Director for Mecklenburg County, Dr. Andrew Pekosh, Professor and Vice Chair of the Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins, and Dr. David Wall, Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at UNC, the University of North Carolina. And I asked a question that you could not possibly answer in the time allotted, Dr. Wall, before the break, and that is, what's at risk with these confusing instructions coming out of the federal government and with the rise of vaccine skepticism?
Yeah, no, it is a loaded question. There's a lot to unpack there, but really just basically, I think, unfortunately for me, we are questioning vaccines. And I think a lot of us in this field, especially those of us who think about public health and infectious diseases, we've taken for granted just how important vaccines are. And you know, it's as if we were talking right now about seatbelts. Can you imagine if we were having a big debate right now about the safety of seatbelts, and people would point out, but I heard about this case of someone getting hurt in an accident by a seatbelt or airbags. It just kind of scratches your head. Look, I know there's people listening out there who are shaking their head, who are saying, but wait. And I get it. I understand that. We don't have 30 years of experience with the mRNA vaccines. We don't. And what we don't have in the scale of time, we do have in the scope of people who've gotten the vaccine, millions of people who've gotten this vaccine. And that has showed us that these are really safe. I rolled up my sleeve. I walk the walk, I talk the talk. I've been vaccinated. My kids have been vaccinated. Now the mRNA technology that we talked about, really important tool. Turning our back on that is like turning our back on wireless or other things that, you know, are really innovative and new. So I think it's really important people understand many of us are alive here today. We don't know who we are, but we're alive here today because of a vaccine, either because we took it or someone else took it and didn't infect us. So it's really important. The other thing, of course, is I know people are saying, well, we don't know. But you know what, Mike, I've seen wards full of people with COVID-19. I see people in the emergency room with COVID-19. Even now, there's a sprinkling of people with COVID-19 in our ICU. We have long COVID clinics. We don't have clinics for people who've had COVID vaccine injuries or side effects. We don't see people hospitalized in wards dedicated to people who've had vaccine or immunization related injury because they're just so few. There's no question the balance, on balance, just how the benefits outweigh even the very small risks. So if we lose that, we lose a lot.
Dr. Washington, I think that the analogy of seatbelts is a good one for another reason, and that is because in the seatbelt conversation, even the bicycle helmet conversation, there are people who say, I don't want to wear a seatbelt. It's my choice. It's my car. I'm driving it. If I die, I die. It's my choice. I don't want to be told what to do. And that's one of the arguments against these vaccines. The state of Florida has just made vaccinations of all kinds optional for school children. Florida Surgeon General and the state's governor argue that parents should have full autonomy over vaccination decisions. Dr. Joseph Ladapo, who is the Surgeon General of the state of Florida, has described mandates as, and this is a quote, dripping with disdain and slavery, and characterized his rollback as a defense of personal freedom. You're a public health person. If parents follow through and don't have their children vaccinated in large numbers, what is the likely outcome as a public health official? How concerned are you about this?
So, Mike, thank you a lot for the question. And I actually was going to jump in because I think the risk that we have to deal with is so extends so far beyond COVID-19 and really exists in the myriad of other infectious illnesses that are currently challenging our health and public health systems. And it's already happening. And so even with very small numbers of children not being vaccinated, either because of medical or religious exemptions, that number is growing, and the growth in that number has resulted in growth in infections among kids and conditions that, as has already been described, we are accustomed to not seeing. This is measles. This is mumps. It's rubella. It's whooping cough. It's varicella, conditions that we have largely had under control that we are experiencing now, not only just conditions or infections, but also deaths. I believe just last week, another child died as a result of the large measles outbreak that we had. Just this week, we established an outbreak of pertussis here at a local institution of learning. And so it's happening. Our pertussis numbers in Mecklenburg County have grown exponentially in the last couple of years. And the majority of the folks who are experiencing those infections are not vaccinated. They're not up to date on their vaccines. And so the science, I think, is very clear. The risk is that that science is going to be clouded with this sort of political narrative that continues to spin. And just to be clear about Florida, there's a plan and recommendations to do that, but it's not the law yet. And so I do think that there are just like in North Carolina, our legislature does have to weigh in on any of those kinds of changes and really can't be unilaterally changed at the executive level. So, but that is what's at risk. And I want just one more thing about sort of the risk of what's happening at the CDC, and I'll wrap this up. There are a lot of incredible scientists at the CDC who are no longer there, either because of employment, staffing cuts, reductions in forces, or voluntary resignations for a lot of different reasons. That science is so critical to our nation's health, to protecting our health, that defense layer that is there. And so the reality of not having that that strength and knowledge and understanding of how to protect our communities from health is a major risk, not just on infectious diseases, but across the spectrum of things that are threats to our health. And it is a really scary reality that we're facing as a community.
Well, to be clear, I want to get your opinion on what happens if the state of Florida's legislature says, okay, the governor and the surgeon general are right about this. We will not require any vaccinations for any children going to any school in our state. What happens then?
Well, in truth, I think based on, you know, the evidence from a lot of recent surveys that have been conducted at the population level, I think the majority of families will continue to get their children vaccinated as if they were, there was a requirement to do so. There is, though, however, a growing number of families who tend to be geographically concentrated in areas who will choose not to get their children vaccinated. And the risk of that is because those kids are likely in the same neighborhoods, the same communities, you'll have these pockets of kids who are vulnerable to infectious illness, and those outbreaks will start to happen. And just like that happened in West Texas, that will spread very quickly from that geographic pocket to places in the nearby areas, and it will cause infections to increase. And we'll have to be dealing with the consequences of those.
So, Dr. Wall, people are very suspicious of the deep state. They're very suspicious of all the institutions that have sustained us throughout most of our history as a country all of a sudden. But we used to trust the CDC. We used to trust the Department of Health and Human Services, et cetera. Now we have another set of people who don't trust them because of what's going on there under the leadership of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And that is increasing the pressure on state and local public health institutions to take up the slack. How do you see this change, what's happening in Washington and how it's impacting communities around the country?
Yeah, you're right. It is, head spinning that we saw that there were really some stoked distrust of some of our institutions, of experts. And I think there was some opportunism at play there politically, and we suffered for that. And now we have a circumstance where there are really valid concerns about the leadership of really what Dr. Washington described as a stellar organization that has kept us safe for decades and really plays a valuable role. So now, remember back to the early days of the vaccines. A lot of people were skeptical of the vaccines. This was coming out of Operation Warp Speed and out of a Trump administration that many people had some skepticism and cynicism about, but yet many of us were converted. We saw what the data showed. Right. Many of us looked at those trials and said, oh, my God, these vaccines are working and working quickly. And we were converts. So I think look at the data, look at the information, cut through the fog. But I do feel right now there's a deliberate taking down and dismantling of trusted organizations. And we should be suspicious of that.
Dr. Pekosh, when COVID first presented, it was a killer. Hundreds of millions of people around the world succumbed. And this virus, like the flu virus, like other viruses, is constantly mutating. And it seems, maybe it's a byproduct of the number of people who have been vaccinated versus prior to the pandemic, none of us had been, but it seems to be not as lethal. Is that because it has mutated to the point where it isn't as lethal, but it still does take lives? Or if that, even if that's the case, could a more lethal variant emerge like that?
Yeah. The lethality of this virus is really a factor of two things. If you look in childhood infections, you can still see very severe infections when it's your first or second SARS-CoV-2 infection. So the virus itself is still maintaining the ability to cause disease. It sort of makes sense. The virus really kind of relies on you to have some symptoms to help it spread. I think the biggest factor is that we now have population immunity to at least some level. So again, virtually everybody over the age of five has some antibodies that recognize SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. They provide varying degrees of protection, and this is where the vaccine becomes so important. It becomes a safe way to, at a particular time of the year when you're vaccinated, to boost that immunity to a level that will provide more protection from infection. So it's really that population immunity that is driving the drop in severity across all age groups. And the safest way to maintain that population immunity is through vaccination, right? It's no longer, you know, why would you be infected with a virus, which again, we call it mild, but if you look, talk to someone who's had COVID recently, right? People have been out of work 2-3 days, they don't have very nice things to say about their COVID infections. So even though we say it's mild and people aren't going to the hospital, it still causes a very significant disease. And the vaccine across all age groups is a much better way of getting that immunity that will help us keep the mortality rate down. Can something emerge? Absolutely. And we're currently monitoring across the world for the emergence of new variants that might have more mutations in them, that might escape this pre-existing immunity, or that might lead to even better transmission. A lot of those efforts, again, they're just a fraction of what they used to be. But certainly there are scientists that are monitoring globally for new variants to try to find them as soon as possible and try to put them on the radar screen of public health individuals.
Most of us get a new flu shot every year because the flu does change from year to year, and scientists have to guess ahead of time about which variant is going to be the one that's most critical so that they can develop a vaccine in time for it to be in use. The mRNA technology for the COVID shot is different, and it doesn't require that same amount of lead time to get the thing done, but we're still taking these boosters. I don't think I've taken a booster shot for measles. I don't think I've taken a booster shot for polio, and I've had all those immunizations. Why do we have to have these repeated vaccinations for flu and COVID? Why?
There's a couple of reasons, and it all points back to the type of viruses that we're vaccinating against. So measles, for example, it's an RNA virus that mutates, but it turns out in those really important parts of the virus, the surface proteins where antibodies can bind to and stop infection, the virus doesn't have a lot of room to maneuver there. So it can't introduce mutations that escape from immunity as easily as flu or as COVID-19 can. Same with polio. There's just some restrictions in terms of what the virus can do. And so in both of those cases, a vaccine that generates those strong antibodies actually works really, really well to limit infection. With SARS, with influenza, the virus there has grown and adapted to be able to introduce more of those mutations that avoid those antibody binding sites. And so it's those viruses are just a completely different beast when it comes to a target for vaccines. And that's one of the reasons why we have to have these annual vaccines. And you bring up a great point, Mike. You know, with flu and the antiquated technology we use to make most of our flu vaccine, we have to make a decision back in February about this year's flu vaccine. For SARS-CoV-2, we could make that decision in June. And that essentially means that we're much better at matching the vaccine with the SARS-CoV-2 mRNA vaccine technology than we are with even our flu vaccines.
When he was appearing before Congress prior to his approval to be Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had already expressed some unorthodox views about vaccines and the science behind them, and yet he was confirmed by the Senate. Dr. Washington, how do you, as a public health official, view this appointment of somebody who holds these unorthodox views and is not shy about expressing them and now seems to be acting on them in some way that negates science, and yet he's heading an agency whose job it is to use that science to protect public health?
Well, Mark, I think it's clear as you just described. It's certainly concerning for all of us if the leadership of some of the most critical institutions that protect health in our community is in any way compromised in terms of what they are focused on. I will say there's been a lot of discussion about Health and Human Services at the CDC and about vaccines. And I think for all of us, it's a bit frustrating because there are so many issues that are facing the health of this nation. And if I think about the most important threat to our health as a community, vaccines are on the positive and helping us and not on the negative as the enemy. And so as I think about the things that are causing death that are preventable in our community, I would really appreciate, and I think most of us would, more focus on the things that actually are causing death, right? Your heart disease is the leading cause of death, stroke, diabetes. We continue to have the leading cause of preventable death is tobacco. And I haven't heard a conversation about smoking and tobacco to date. And I know we have more kids vaping nowadays. There are real issues. The opioid epidemic continues to be a real challenge for us. And so if I think about what I look for in leadership at the federal level from Health and Human Services, that's the kind of conversations I want to be having. How do we tackle childhood obesity? How do we tackle the growing rate of chronic illness among children? Unfortunately, we're not hearing that. And I think that's where most of our frustration is coming.
And there's a lot of confusion about where to get the shot, the COVID shot, the current one, who has access to it. Do you need a prescription? Some states, including ours, are taking their own actions, which we'll talk about when we come back. And yet there is still confusion, which we will try to clear up in the next 20 minutes as we continue our conversation with Dr. Raynard Washington from Mecklenburg County, Dr. David Wall from the University of North Carolina, and Dr. Andrew Pekosh with Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, home ownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're getting a COVID update, vaccine recommendations, and accessibility this morning because it's very confusing. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Secretary of Health and Human Services, has issued new rules that govern access to COVID vaccines. They are confusing and, to some, very concerning. I want to play a rather lengthy exchange between Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. when he testified earlier this month before the Senate Finance Committee. She and other senators took him to task for restricting the COVID vaccines after promising last November at his appointment hearings not to take away anyone's access to those vaccines.
Last November, while you were under consideration to become Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mr. Kennedy, you said, quote, if vaccines are working for somebody, I'm not going to take them away. No exceptions, no ifs, ands, or buts. You would not take away vaccines from anyone who wanted them. Then last week, you announced that the COVID-19 vaccine is no longer approved for healthy people under the age of 65. In announcing the change, you said the vaccine will be available for anyone who wants it. Now, obviously, both things cannot be true at the same moment. So let's clear this up right now, Secretary Kennedy. Will you tell America that all adults and all children over 6 months of age are eligible to get a COVID booster at their local pharmacy today?
Anybody can get the booster.
I'm sorry?
Anybody can get it.
Senator. Anybody. So you're saying that is now the official rule of HHS. Anybody is eligible to get a booster by just walking into the pharmacy.
It's not recommended for healthy people.
No. If you don't recommend, then the consequence of that in many states is that you can't walk into a pharmacy and get one. It means insurance companies don't have to cover the $200 or so cost. As Senator Dr. Cassidy said, you are effectively denying people vaccines.
We're not going to recommend a product for which there's no clinical data for that indication. Is that what I should be doing?
What you should be doing is honoring your promise that you made when you were looking to get confirmed in this job.
You're going like this.
And that is, you promised that you would not take away vaccines from anyone who wanted them. You just changed the classification of the COVID vaccine.
I'm not taking them away from people, Senator.
It takes it away if you can't get it from your pharmacist.
Well, most Americans are going to be able to get it from their pharmacy for free.
It's mind-boggling, and it's difficult to put the politics aside from this, but let's try to do this for a minute because it really has no place in any discussion revolving around science. They're completely divorced from each other. But in that clip, Dr. Pekosh, Kennedy said that it depends on the states, but that everyone can still get it. He also said in his capacity as the head of the Department of Health and Human Services that it is not recommended for healthy people. I saw you react to that. Give me your opinion of that. Should it be recommended for healthy people?
Well, and then the other thing he clearly said, right, was that there was no clinical data to support its use, which is completely untrue. And I think this speaks to the broader issue that's coming here with this RFK Jr.-led administration is scientific evidence is no longer appreciated or utilized or driving any types of decision to do anything. We've focused here on vaccines, but I think this reflects across a lot of the other chronic diseases and other things that people maybe initially were really attracted to here. The vaccine works. The vaccine works across age groups. Would we love to have a better vaccine that had a higher efficacy? Absolutely. But again, as we discussed earlier, some of these limitations are basically the kind of virus that SARS-CoV-2 is. It's very much more similar to flu, where we know our vaccines work every year. They work across age groups, and they won't work. They don't work to the 90%+ we may want to, but they do work.
Let me get to the point that he's saying it's not recommended for healthy people.
Yeah.
Healthy people get COVID. Is he saying that healthy people will not be severely impacted by COVID because our eyesight, our sense of history tells us that is a complete falsehood?
Yeah, I think that they're looking at some of the extremes. When you look at the mortality rates, certainly the mortality rates are lower in healthy younger individuals, but the case rates are just as high and the emergency room visits are there and the vaccine would help reduce those rates if it was used more effectively. And I think the other thing that's important to note is, you know, we talked a little bit about vaccines protecting the individual, but vaccines also provide a population effect. If you can reduce the overall circulation of viruses that are vaccine preventable, you can reduce the chance in which a vulnerable person can get an infection, and therefore you make the vaccine almost work at a higher efficacy, right? Because you're reducing the risk of getting exposed. You're also vaccinating those high-risk people. And you only accomplish that goal of reducing cases in a population if you have a population-wide vaccine campaign.
Dr. Wall.
Yeah, really, really quickly. So the vaccines work, and Senator Kennedy knows the vaccines work. So CDC, really reputable people, did a wonderful study that was published by the CDC just recently that showed from 2023 to 2024, from September to August of those years, over 107,000 hospitalizations were averted by vaccination, 118,000 ICU admissions, 18,000, 6,700 deaths. In hospital, deaths averted. So we're talking about thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who didn't suffer because of vaccine. The other thing we should be really clear about, we're not talking about mandates for vaccination. We're talking about choice. This is all about people like me. I am 61, Mike. I don't have any of the conditions listed by the CDC. I'm a frontline healthcare worker. Mike, I'm not eligible to get the COVID-19 booster today. I'm not. So I would have to get, right? I'd have to get a prescription off label and then hope that my insurance company would cover a vaccine for me to get vaccinated today. I want the choice. We're not talking about everyone should get vaccinated 100%. A lot of us are immune. My daughter had is 25. She had COVID 3 weeks ago. She's probably good, you know, to be honest with you. And Dr. Pekosh would tell you, her immune cells, they're geared up against the variant that's circulating right now. But you know what? Some of us want the choice, especially pregnant women, especially people like me. We should have that choice.
And this choice comes with strings attached if you have to get a prescription. Dr. Washington, from somebody who's a public health official, there is a question about whether you can get a prescription. To get that prescription, you have to have a physician prescribe it. Some people in the lower income brackets may not have that access. They may not be insured. And if they are insured and their insurance doesn't cover the shot, are these unnecessary barriers to choice?
The very short answer to that is absolutely. I think, you know, we have been talking about issues of equity as it relates to not just COVID response, but just health and opportunity for health in general, and the importance for us to close gaps in life expectancy that exist in our community across a variety of demographics and income brackets. Individuals who have to seek medical care to be able to even get access to a COVID vaccine will in fact create barriers for some of the most vulnerable among us. You think about having the folks in long-term care facilities who cannot just get up and go to the doctor, right? They have to see a physician on site. They have to get a prescription, then they have to get the medication prescribed. Think about our seniors who are living independently, right? That's also cost associated with that doctor's visit, right? There's either a copay or a cost of the visit. Then there's the question of if my insurance company is going to cover the cost of it, of the vaccine itself, which can be upwards of $180 for a booster shot. If you are on a fixed income or not, that is cost prohibitive. And you've got to make a decision about accessing healthy food or something else or transportation at the same time, or even getting your flu shot too, you're talking about, you know, several hundred dollars for an individual just to keep themselves healthy and safe. And so it is certainly a barrier and should not be in this country.
So in the face of the confusion that these policy shifts have resulted in at the federal level, it's up to the states now, excuse me, to do the heavy lifting. Arizona, Illinois, Maine, and our state are among the early list of states taking steps to fill the void. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein announced just last week that he is doing just that, and here is why.
Right now, North Carolina is one of only a handful of states where people must get a prescription before they can get a shot at the pharmacy.
And here is what he's doing about it.
I've directed DHHS State Health Director, Dr. Larry Greenblatt, to issue standing orders if he agreed in his medical judgment. Dr. Greenblatt has issued these orders, which allows pharmacies statewide to provide COVID-19 vaccines to senior citizens, as well as adults over 18 who meet the CDC's list of high-risk conditions without having to get a patient-specific prescription.
That list includes cancer, kidney, liver, heart, or lung disease, cystic fibrosis, Parkinson's disease, diabetes type 1 and 2, HIV infection, tuberculosis, pregnancy, mental health or mood disorders, and many, many more. The order takes effect, Dr. Wall, immediately, and yet there are some counties whose health departments, even under this order, are not providing COVID vaccines, and that includes Durham County, of all places. Why not?
Yeah, I think, you know, Dr. Washington, I think, could speak a little bit more about the availability of vaccines, you know, at health departments. More and more during the COVID pandemic, we saw incredible innovations, you know, home tests, things like that, but also people getting vaccines at pharmacies in an unprecedented way. pharmacies have become really the first point of contact for a lot of people for vaccines now for good reasons. So I think that's really where the action's happening. This order helps prevent people from having to go to a doctor to get a prescription if they qualify under the new licensing requirements, meaning 65 and above, you don't need now to go to a doctor and get a prescription. Or if you're 18 to 65 and you have one of those conditions, you don't have to go. So it really expands maybe a little bit of access, but we're still stuck, right? People like me are still stuck. So it reduces one barrier amongst multiple barriers. It's not exactly what some other states have done, such as in New York, where the governor issued an emergency order. We see lots of emergency orders and executive orders from the president. This is a governor's emergency order that says this is an emergency and now allows for wide use of the vaccines.
Dr. Washington, is Mecklenburg County Health Department, are they providing this shot? Are the departments of health in the other surrounding counties around Charlotte providing these shots?
Yes, we are. And one of the challenges that we have faced has obviously been awaiting an updated standing order from the state. And it's also probably is what's happening with my colleague in Durham, which has also limited our ability to be able to order the actual product to get it into the clinic and on the shelves. And so with all of the for lack of a better word, I'll say chaos that's been created. There's also sort of a domino effect in terms of if vaccines are not produced and approved on schedule, then our ability to order across the country is delayed. And then what happens is, unfortunately, what's happening now, where COVID is already off to the races, and we are behind the eight ball because we don't have inventory. There's not clarity on policy. And as you mentioned already, ACIP is just meeting this week. And so we are, we have had a summer surge for the last 5 years of COVID, right? So we know what's going to happen. So we shouldn't be behind the eight ball, but shame on us for not getting ahead.
So you just mentioned ACIP that I think we talked about off the air. We didn't talk about it on the air. Let's talk about it now, Dr. Pekosh, because approval of the FDA for COVID vaccines is not the only step in the process of making these vaccines available to the public. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, a panel of independent experts that guides vaccine policy, has not yet voted or issued guidance on the current vaccines. They will meet Thursday, 2 days from now, to vote on the scale of the release of this vaccine. And typically, the CDC issues recommendations based on that panel's guidance. But in June, RFK Jr. fired all 17 members of the advisory committee and replaced some of them with new members, many of whom have expressed anti-vaccine views. And more are coming on board, I believe, this week with similar views. You're a scientist. You are familiar with the science behind these vaccines as anyone on walking on the planet. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, all of this sounds, again, like a non-scientific, non-evidence-based approach to trying to make some vaccine decisions this week. There is a wealth of data that is available to this ACIP committee that helps them determine the actual vaccine policy that the U.S. will instill. It seems very odd to me that you bring someone on board a committee 2 days before the committee meets. That puts a huge amount of information in front of them that they have to digest relatively quickly before making a decision that's going to affect millions upon millions of people's health. It does not, again, sound like this is a decision that's been made using science and the evidence and the best way to analyze that evidence. The individuals that were chosen to put on here have some experience in some places, but certainly they either lack specific long-term histories of being able to work in these kind of areas and make these decisions, or have expressed anti-vaccine views that, again, are not evidence-based in the past.
So, Dr. Washington, I have less than a minute left. What are your recommendations? What should people do who want this shot, even if they fall into the category where they have to get a prescription?
Well, I think they should seek healthcare. So I would say for folks who are eligible to get it at a pharmacy without a prescription in the list that we just described, that's adults with underlying health conditions and older adults over 65, operate sort of status quo. For other adults, please seek care, please call the health department if you don't know where to go. And we're certainly happy to help direct you to one of our community providers who can help get you a prescription for the vaccine.
And yes or no, Dr. Wall, there is no empirical evidence that RFK Jr. has used to be opposed to these vaccines, correct?
I'd love to see the data, and we just haven't seen it.
Okay. Dr. David Wall from the University of North Carolina, Dr. Reynard Washington from Mecklenburg County, and Dr. Andrew Prakash from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.